Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
What's good, internet? It is Monday, March 12th, 2018, and you are listening to Waypoint Radio. Happy Daylight Savings Day.
Time.
It's sunny out. It means it's going to be sunny for later.
That's what that means, right?
It's sunny. There's the sun. I can see the sun.
What? You're only like 3 miles away from me. It's not sunny.
I'm behind some clouds, but the sun is out. What do you want from me?
I don't know.
How's everybody feeling on this glorious Monday morning? Afternoon. It's afternoon. It's not really the morning at all. I'm Austin Walker. Joining me, obviously, the apparently the sun hating Danielle Riendo.
I love the sun, but it is cloudy, gloomy ass day. Also, hi.
Hi. Also joining me today, Patrick Klepek. How do you feel?
Rob. What the fuck do you have? You work from home too. Like, daylight savings time is like the greatest day of the calendar year because it means it is not dark at 4 o'clock when we work from home, which like my productivity goes off a cliff at 4 o'clock because I look behind me and like, oh, the sun's gone. It's dark out now.
Is that a work from home thing?
I think it's an everybody thing.
Yeah.
Really. But look, here's the thing. I don't object to, like, you shifting time so that, like, it's lighter later in the day.
Yeah.
That's fine. That's whatever. It is that once a year, you jump forward an hour. You lose an hour on your weekend. But more importantly, if you work from home, something that you really, really become dependent on is, like, schedules that you keep and rhythms that you can sort of follow yourself, right? Because, like, you don't have a ton of, like, external pressures to sort of keep you on track with that. So it's like kind of a delicate balance. It's a fine-tuned machine over here, Patrick. And when you just lose an hour and you get up and suddenly it's like late morning and not mid-morning, and then you're playing catch-up for the rest of the day and you realize, like, holy shit, I'm just going to be an hour behind for the entire week. And I'm going to feel slightly exhausted because I still can't fall asleep on time, which means I'm either sleeping in, or in the case of today, I got up on time and I'm running on like 3-4 hours of sleep.
Yeah.
That's fun. That's cool.
All right. So horrible. You're saying if we passed a law and just said, this is the last one, we've switched, we're here, then we're on the same page. Your problem is that it messes with your biorhythms when we're switching back and forth.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
Pretty much.
And all also, right. Then we're not that far apart.
Here's a question. Wait, why do we switch the other way later in the year? This is a thing that I learned once, and it's been a long time since I've thought about it.
Farmers, right?
That's what they say.
Except for, was it Arizona? They passed. They did.
Yeah,
they
Arizona
the dream.
Doesn't do it.
And
parts of Indiana.
That's
right. Parts of Indiana. That's
like
true.
Notre Dame doesn't.
That's not far from me. I could go.
South Bend. Is that right? South Bend.
Sure.
Indiana. Yeah. No, yeah, just go there, Patrick. Just move there. No more daylight savings for you.
Oh,
spendings. That's what Patrick wants.
Then there's the whole like capitalist conspiracy aspect of this, which we should not overlook, right?
I'm like, all ears. Let's go.
Daylight savings time didn't used to be as long as it is. Like I don't mean an hour. I mean like it didn't run for as much of the year. Like I think it was daylight savings. We keep it later into the year, and we started earlier than we used to, in part because I think it was like the National Organization of Retailers lobbied to have that changed because they figured out that if it's lighter later, people do more shopping. And so there was kind of this like effort just to like change how we define like parts of the day so that we could go and be good little consumers, because in a lot of ways, this entire system is about transforming American citizens into resources that can be strip mined by their economy.
Right. Sure. I just want to point this out. There's a headline here. This is one of those, like, the it's telling of the times. 2013, November 1st, 2013, different time. Daylight, this is from the Atlantic. Daylight savings time is America's greatest shame. Daylight savings time is the greatest continuing fraud ever perpetrated on the American people. Ugh.
Wow. Different times, different
easy
priorities.
There, Ian.
Yeah, it wasn't Ian, sadly. Sadly, I can't point to Ian on this one. This was Alexander Abad Santos. But still, Atlantic, I'm fine with going to town with daylight savings time. Greatest fraud, greatest of shame. Maybe a bit much. I slept a lot this weekend. I did my catch up sleep for the year, I guess, because I went to bed at 4 or 5 a.m. one night and woke up at that same number, but p.m. And it was after that was after the daylight savings time hour already happened.
Did you feel good?
No, I felt terrible. I woke up and I was like, yo, something hit me. Like, I felt so bad. Don't do that. It was the fucked up thing was I looked at my phone the night before and I was like, should I set an alarm for 11? Nah, fuck it. I'll just sleep till 12. Nope. Slept till 4:45, something like that.
Oh my god.
It was bad. I don't know what happened because normally I sleep. At most, I sleep 8 hours. I get a full 8 hours, and I'm up. And I'm just like, all right, I'm up now. That's it. I'm good to go.
What's
going to
be great is in a couple days when people start asking you about things they saw you doing that day.
Right.
Where people are like, man, what were you doing in Midtown on Sunday?
On Sunday. That was right. You know I was in town. Why didn't you? I saw you there. You said you were busy, but, you know. I don't know.
You're
I guess
sleepwalk.
I had some things to do. Yeah, I had to do some errands, some sleepwalking errands.
You were sleep shopping. Because of the fucking because of daylight savings.
That's the secret trick.
They're gonna literally
wake up. Because if you don't, you're gonna turn into a zombie consumer. God,
Jesus.
What I actually did was I played some video games. I played a few video games over the weekend. The one I'm not gonna spend any time talking about is Dragon's Dogma. But let me just remind everybody that Dragon's Dogma is still a good game that makes me feel good. That's what I did that night that I woke up after 12 hours of sleep. I was like, I gotta feel like me. I gotta feel like myself. What can I do? I'll play Dragon's Dogma for a little bit.
Give us the MMO.
Seriously, just give it to us. We need to look into how hard it would be to proxy our way into that thing. Did you know that team is partly at least the Monster Hunter team? Or, that team went on to co-make Monster Hunter World?
Yeah, I think, I think the lead went on to, he's working on that unannounced Devil May Cry, and then, yes, a huge amount of the team of Dragon's Dogma, rather than making Dragon's Dogma 2, went on.
Sad.
But imagine if they made Dragon's Dogma 2 and it was as good as
Monster Hunter World, I would lose my shit. Oh, I'm so upset now. Anyway,
just take Monster Hunter World and put... Yep. Okay.
Never mind. Yeah, I'm with you. Yep. I also played some Metro 2033, which we're also not going to talk about because tomorrow we're actually going to record our Metro 2033 Waypoint 101. So if you have questions, you should email those in to gamingadvice.com, and I'm sure our host Rob Zachney will be happy to find the best ones. We have a form over on the threads, or over on the
threads.
We got a thread over on the form.
Got those
about
threads.
It. And I've been streaming it some, so there's some archive. If you haven't watched any of it, if you haven't seen any of it, I've streamed 4 or 5 hours of it, so you can find that over on our Twitch archives. There are links in the thread on the forums, so go check those out. Other than that, it was actually kind of a quiet game. The stuff that I have for gaming to talk about is not out yet, but we did write about it, which is Far Cry 5. I saw that, I guess, a couple of weeks ago now. Stories just went up on the site recently. The review should be the next couple of weeks as they send over a review copy soon. But we never really talked about it here. We just did a stream and I did some articles. I was curious if people had Far Cry questions because I certainly still do.
I mean, I have so many, but can they be answered before?
I don't know. I guess that's the biggest thing about that game, right? Is that after seeing it for as long as I did, so I played it for about 3 hours, interviewed the creative director, Dan Hay, and one of their consultants, one of their cult consultants, Mia Donovan. and you know, had the walkthrough of like what the new systems were and blah blah blah. There's stuff there that I think I can answer pretty definitively, where I think that they're making some big improvements as it you know, on it as an open world franchise. I think that the new system for quests is so much better than climb a tower and get 15 things added to your map. You now kind of get this organic trail from one thing to another. You talk to somebody, you rescue someone, and they go like, oh, I heard that they're you know, forcibly baptizing people over on the river by such and such place, and like that adds an outpost to your map, or it adds like another rescue to your map, or you find a newspaper, or you find a fishing magazine, and that adds fishing locations to the map, or you find a flyer, you know, that's been pinned to a telephone pole that says like, wild cougar has been attacking people lately. There's a bounty out for it. And that's how you add that to your map, instead of just like, I climbed a tower and now there are 15 things on my map. And I like that system quite a bit. And I think there's other stuff there that just totally works. There's a buddy system that I think is really fun. But like, I have no idea if they are even going to try to stick the landing on the thematic narrative political front. And there has been so much backwalking from the original pitch, which had to do mostly with militias and
something I wanted to ask you about is because the initial pitch seemed to be like militias, like there's trouble in the heartland, folks. Yes, things are going sideways. And then this
cults
last
did come up. I want to be clear. There was I don't want to misrepresent the initial pitch that they gave us at Judges Week. The word cult was, of course, said, and there was talk about extremist religious movements too. But they leaned really hard into the militia stuff. They leaned really hard into it.
Right. And now this most recent event and sort of the resources they were making available to reporters, they were really going out of their way to be like, we're about cults. Like, we know all about cults.
We know all about
cults.
You
got cult questions? We're here to answer them.
You know, one of the... I wrote this in the preview piece, but there's a lot of, not all militias happening in this game, or at least some of it, right? Like, the
wow.
Seriously. It starts, right away in the sense. The game opens by you going in to kind of try to arrest this cult leader. There's kind of a mysterious evangelical apocalyptic cult. You know, there's a cross, but no one's mentioned Jesus by name yet. The word God has come up a bunch in that opening. This is someone who believes that the end times are coming and everyone needs to prepare for it and everyone needs to join up, get in that bunker or whatever. I'm not sure what the specific end times of this faith look like. But get ready for it. And you gotta be a prep. You gotta be prepped. You gotta be a prepper. And then immediately you're saved by a prepper. Immediately you're saved by a prepper who just looks exactly like the creative director of this game. He's a big white dude with a good beard and very intense face. Nothing. I'm not judging. Rob, listen, live your life. But you also are not a prepper, as far as I know. The other guy who saved you is just like, oh yeah, bad stuff's coming. I've been getting ready. I have this bunker filled with guns. And you're the good one? Okay, I guess we're all together now. Cool. And then one of the first factions that you're supposed to meet up with is just another local militia. And it's it feels very defensive in a sense of we can't, not all militias, not all preppers, not all dudes, you know, not all white evangelicals. And of course there is a diversity of experiences. Of course there are groups, you know, one of my favorite Facebook groups is a kind of a radical Marxist, Southern, group. I forget the actual name of it, but it's really fucking good and really heartfelt, and it's a sort of leftism that doesn't begin in kind of coastal cities, and so it's just very authentic and very reflects an actual working class background. It's really great. And so yes, of course there's a diversity of experiences in rural America. I'm not saying that it all boils down to fuck rural America. But there's a lot of talking out of both sides of your mouth in this in this game. And thematically, I don't think anything shows that more than there's an encounter early on with... Do y'all remember Herc from the last two games? Far Cry 3 and 4? Also in Primal, there is a Herc ancestor.
Really thought you meant a different Herc.
Herc from...
From The Wire.
From The Wire. I mean, there's overlap in those two character types. Far Cry's Herc is maybe a little less...
He's less intentionally an asshole, I suppose.
Yeah, totally. You meet his dad in this. He shows up and his dad is a senatorial candidate, presumably for the Republican Party, because he's the kind of mission for him is that his campaign truck gets stolen. And you have to go get it back. And he says,
Tell them what the campaign truck's name is.
Oh, sorry. The campaign's truck is Nancy, named after the greatest first lady of all time.
Direct quote right there.
I think that's like, okay, that's a pretty funny, okay, you've characterized this guy. I get it. He's the sort of guy who has a campaign truck named after Nancy Reagan. Sure. Follows that up by saying, like, if you don't get that, if the Obama-loving libtards see that I'm so weak that my truck got stolen, I'll never hear the end of it. And it's like, whew, okay, who's that joke for? Like,
yep.
That joke's for me, because I'm supposed to be like, this fucking guy, fuck this guy, this guy sucks, ha ha ha. But it's also for anybody who actually says the words Obama-loving libtards, whereas it's like, this fucking guy, this guy's great. And there's a lot of that throughout the game, insofar as I've played it so far. And this is the thing, is like, there's a limit to what I can say here, because games like this, games like Far Cry, often will, like, drizzle out a bunch of different feelings throughout their side characters and try to appeal to a bunch of different audiences in a bunch of different ways. And then they still kind of end up presenting a through line that you can then see the rest of those things orbiting around. So, like, in 3, it didn't really matter that there were characters who I did like throughout that experience or who that I thought were kind of interesting, because the through line was so poisonous for me. It was so just like, this main dude sucks so bad. They're never confronting his own shittiness. Like, it ends up just being this really gross power fantasy of this, like, white savior coming to save these people. And in 4, the opposite was true, which was, like, I generally disliked a lot of what was on the edges of that game. And I think mechanically it didn't go far enough forward, but, like, the through line, I actually resonated with me in a real way, and I liked the major characters, or at least was interested in them. And so it's hard to say at this point what's up with Far Cry 5 in terms of, like, whether or not it sticks that landing, but I'm very frustrated by the fact that initial pitch was so heavy on an angle that they have since had to walk back. And I don't know if that reflects changes in the game or if that just reflects changes in the marketing. And I guess we'll see, you know?
The thing for me, obviously seeing a lot of the footage and being somewhat excited for it, I suppose, based somewhat on that, you know, that original angle, but also the fact, like you, I think, Austin, I had a lot of fun with 4. And I sort of enjoyed 4 a lot and thought 4, not fixed, but at least attempted to make steps towards sort of fixing what sucked about 3. I guess we're in this weird time now where I'm more conscious than ever about, like, do I really have the time for this if this is going to be a really milquetoast thing about something that I think is actually toxic in America? Like, do I really have the time for certain things or the sort of ability to hand wave anymore? And I don't know, obviously we're not talking about just this game, but that idea to me is really present whenever I'm thinking about this game coming out.
Yeah, it's one of those tough things where you know it's also going to be a big meaty experience, right? It's going to take dozens of hours to get through. And I think, like many games like this and like many Ubisoft games, it's going to be squirrely about whether or not you like it. Like, I think about Watch Dogs 2, which is a game I came away by the end of it really liking, but there were moments where I was like, man, fuck this game. And it sometimes takes a lot of time for me to work my head around it, but I, to some degree, it's like, that's the job. But it's, I don't know, we had this talk with Kingdom Come Deliverance, right? Like, there is definitely, as there are more and more games released, as Steam just becomes a fucking flood of new games every single day, there are countless things we could be doing with our time, you know?
Right.
That said, I'm curious. I have such a deep curiosity about this that I'm going to keep digging in. I'm excited to review it, and we'll see how it all shakes out, you know? If you want to know more of, like, thoughts on this, again, waypointdevice.com, just search for Far Cry 5. We also did a kind of a pretty long let's play of, or a view, or not a let's play, but we talked over footage I'd captured while playing, and answered a lot of questions there. So if you have questions that we did not just answer in this last little 5-minute bit, definitely go look that up. That's over on youtube.com/waypointvice. What else? What have y'all been playing? Since I've been talking about things I don't want to talk about or can't talk about too much, what have y'all been actually digging into?
It sounds like Danielle and I have been playing a lot of the same game, actually. Yep. Although it sounds like she's played maybe 40 hours more than I have.
Yeah, do you want to start, Patrick, or do you want to...
Well, I'm actually more curious to start with your turn on the game, okay. And then I can jump in from there. But yeah, we're both playing a lot of into the Breach. I'm at a curious point that was played out in our Discord that I can get to, but I'm curious to hear your thoughts on where you went from a game that you weren't very into to were very into, and then it sounds like you might be on that same point again. So
I still can't stop. I'm just it's Stockholm syndrome at this point again. So what happened? And like I honestly, Steam tells me I have like 50 hours in. That's not entirely accurate because I do kind of keep it on during.
I was going to say
a little bit.
Like either you have been doing no work last week, or you, as right. I later surmise, I believe she's just leaving Into the Breach on, and it's
I am.
it's on right now. To be honest,
yeah, it is. On right now. Uh-huh. It's in the background. I'm just staring at a screen of
it.
That's all.
100% not.
All right, it's just on in the background. Friends. It's fine.
If Danielle
it's fine.
Gets really quiet, she's just listening to you guys. Just,
I'm listening
just paying
intently.
Close attention. Yep.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, so with this game that I've played way too much of and it's starting to ruin my life, I started out sort of enjoying it, yes, because I love the way it looks, and I think I like tactics games. I guess this is something I found out about myself recently with Mario versus Rabbids, where I think I 100%ed it, or came very close to 100%ing it. And this, apparently I like tactics games. This is new. But it looks great. It has a really awesome theme, and it's very, very, very satisfying when you actually do things right. I was really floundering.
It's approachable,
though.
Too, right? Like, I think that's
it
the
is,
commonality
yeah.
you're finding between... Rabbids and this game. Rabbids does a lot more handholding,
sure.
because I think Rabbids wants to teach you. Rabbids is more interested in you having successes and then applying those successes, whereas Into the Breach is more interested in you having failures and applying the lessons from those failures.
Yes.
But they're both they're both approaching the same question from different angles. But they both are, I think, ultimately in the pantheon of strategy games, like very even at, like yourself, like someone that doesn't consider themselves a tactics person playing a lot of strategy games. Both of these games are you at least curious? Then, like, these games are, you know, openings into seeing and kind of playing around with the genre.
Yeah, I think so. I think so, absolutely. But yeah, I was having a really hard time, especially with permadeath. I just was not prioritizing things well enough at first. And then I had this breakthrough, and I wrote about it a little bit last week, where I sort of was like, no, it's triage, man. I just have to think about it as triage. It's like treating, I had to think about it like an EMT, basically, like treat the ABCs, airway, breathing, circulation, treat life threats, you know, basically, and sort of just shifting what that actually means in terms of the human body to what that means in terms of this game.
In terms
and then,
of giant bugs that are threatening cities,
yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. Life threats. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah,
this one's going for the carotid. You gotta deal with that before you go with somebody who's going to break your toe. So,
right,
yeah.
Sure.
That's basically how I sort of reframed it in my mind. And then I was like, fucking yes. And immediately made a ton of progress and am like very consistently able to get through at least an island. And then now I'm kind of having trouble with the second island. I'm consistently getting to like the end of a second island. And then I'm having trouble again. But I'm convinced that I will break through again at some point, and I'm sure it'll...
I believe in you.
I believe in me, too. It's just, like, I'm at the point where I'm playing so much of it, I'm dreaming about it, so I...
Oh, wow, you're in.
Yeah,
you're,
I'm in it all
you.
The way.
It has you whether you want it to or not.
Yeah, it has its buggy claws, like, in my brain right now, really, really deep. I think it's a really great game. I am still, like, a little annoyed about certain things, but I man...
Well, what's the stuff that annoys you? Because I'm curious, you know, like Austin, Rob, they come at these games. I'm more on your end, or like
yeah.
we're sort of newcomer. Like, what's the stuff that's annoying you about it? I'm curious how much is endemic to strategy games or how much is specific to what Into the Breach is trying to do.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm at a point now where permadeath isn't ruining my life. It was for a long time because I really was like losing my best pilots all the time and completely on a treadmill and not making any progress because of that until I, you know, sort of learned the prioritization thing. Now I'm at the point where I just really wish things like upgrades didn't feel so random. Like when you get a time pod and it gives you an upgrade, I'm always like, oh, a shiny new toy, and I'll put it on, and then I will not properly use it. I won't test it. I'll just be like, yeah, great, good. I'm good at this game. I put 50 hours in. So it's hubris, really, is my main problem. And the fact that the game has no patience for me being a a toddler who wants to play with toys, basically, which is sort of like my gaming approach to everything. I like to play with everything and test everything out
right.
in a game and not in like a safety room in a game. So
there's an element of yeah. like, you know, immediately when you fucked up.
Yeah.
And that's made it a bit of a difficult game for me to play consistently because like, I mean, I am somebody who like stops everything if there's like a perfect score that I can chase. Mm. Like, and Into the Breach.
good luck with this game.
I had to get over that. I had to get over that too, 100%.
Right. And so like, there are those things where you know that, oh, there was an optimal way to play this. And especially like, yeah, you get a new tool, you get a new ability, or you modify one of your existing abilities. And it doesn't feel like you can't just like, it never feels like there's a free moment to go like, you know, why don't you just get in there and fuck around with this? Yeah. It's always like every move matters. Like, don't be an idiot. Like every time an apartment block goes down and it like if that happens at all, I feel like garbage. But if it happens and I didn't like choose to let it go down, you know what I mean? Like if yeah. I found myself in a position where like, oh, I left myself no out there, and I had to eat that. I'm immediately like, well, this run is basically ruined. Yeah.
So I abandoned yep. dozens of timelines, just completely just like, all right, I'll just start over, because I lost, because I had like a bad first two maps, and I had to, it was really hard for me, but I had to get over that and just push as far as I could into each run instead, and then I immediately started winning, because I was able to... once I started getting enough experience letting myself lose, I was able to kind of right the ship, and it was really hard to get there, especially coming off of FTL, where minor losses, like the hole being damaged, feel so fixable compared to here, where, like, I think partially it's because you only get to buy stuff and repair your grid, your power grid, once after each island, which means yeah. there's long periods of time where they really stretch you out and they go like, all right, like, do you have enough to get through this next one? You do not have a chance to repair before it. Good luck. And you have to push through that stuff. And it was really hard for me to not hit those spaces and be like, oh, fuck it, I'll start over. But once I did, that's when I started making really good progress and filling out all the different achievements, stuff like that. And that's the other big one for me was I started doing runs where I was like, all right, this whole run is about getting this one achievement. And that's going to be how I play around in this game, is like, I want to just get the one where I whip through 10 different tiles. I'm not trying to win. It's okay if shit gets hurt. Fuck it. I'm going to try to get this 10 whip achievement. And then maybe also on the way, get this other achievement on the side, or like make progress to the civilian saved one, or whatever. And that structure helped me get over that feeling of like, if I'm not being perfect, then it's not worth continuing. That said, now I think I've wrapped back around to that perfect play thing, at least on normal. I haven't dug into hard yet. I hear hard is just like brutal in terms of what the turns they set up are.
Great. God.
Because like right now I can look at 90% of my normal turns and find an optimal solution. It's just about time, because I've just gotten the rules down right for what they set up as a normal turn. I have no idea if this is true or not, but as I've put in, you know, I have like 30 hard hours in the game. like I don't have it on in the background when I'm playing it. It's like the only thing I'm doing. And so at this point, my understanding from play is that the turns that they set up most of the time will have a solution. They will have a way for you to free every building, if not kill every enemy. And that's at least on normal. I don't know that that's true on hard. God. I believe that hard is like actually the difficulty there is just about like what situations the AI prepares for you to encounter. And so, yeah, like that's I'm wrapping back around to that perfectionism and on normal. But now I have the skill set to actually execute on it. And that's one of the things that's so interesting to me about this game, is that like it does have permadeath. But even without permadeath, even just like as it naturally plays, you never can like level up to the degree that you can power through something through like numbers alone. You
yeah.
It always still comes down to positioning and like kind of what play you're making, and not just like, do I have the strength? You also need the strength. You also need enough of behind that rocket fist to actually kill the damn thing. And so you do have to be smart about how you level up your characters, but like...
I do feel, yeah. though, like, after Bloodborne, Dark Souls 3, and The Witness, we should have recognized that this was this had potential to be Danielle's Swamps of Sorrow and maybe get ahead of the situation.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
God.
We failed. We failed her.
Yeah, so thanks, Patrick, guys.
What's your situation?
Well, so I kind of dip in and out of the game. Like when my kid takes a nap, I'll like boot up like the – I've had this one really good run going. I made a really – an error that maybe almost abandoned the timeline. So I'm playing as the squad that has the mech with the electric whip.
Yes.
And so the way this one is different, like the basic opening squad is a lot of just like pushing tiles, and that is like, you know, endemic to a lot of the different squads. There's a lot of pushing objects around, but with this one, it's so you have the electric whip, you have one unit that can shoot a boulder that can both act as an attack, but it doesn't do a ton of damage, and you're mostly using it to kind of push things around, and also it can act as a conduit. So, like, let's say you have, you know, an enemy in front of you, a tile in between, and then an enemy beyond that. If you put the boulder in the middle, you can suddenly, you know, attack all of them. And then you can use your own units to, you know, act as conduits. So anyway, that's kind of like the I started playing that squad, felt like didn't make it past like the second like battle, but like just kind of kept banging my head against it. And now I had almost a perfect run on the first two islands. Like I was the same as you, Danielle, where I couldn't get past the second island, and then all of a sudden just had like the run where it all started clicking. Made it through the second island, got to the third island, and was like just stressed that like I'd made it this far, and was so worried about what I was going to lose. I'd lost like my main pilot that I'd been playing for like 5 hours. But I decided to do the Austin thing rather than abandon the timeline or like, oh, fuck it, I'm going to just start over. I mean, the pilot's dead. It's not like I could bring him back. But right. I felt so defeated that like, oh, maybe that was so critical to my progress that I'm just not going to do anything. But actually, like, I've continued to push through. I made it through the third island. The third island was interesting because my battle, often you're trying to kill as many enemies as possible. But actually, the way the grid was set up for me and the amount of power – the amount of attack power I really had, like instead what I did was like, it was a war of attrition. Like I was just moving objects around and blocking off the boss in the third map, where I just was making sure that their attacks, the way the third, the boss works is like, I can set up like these fire streaks that can go across an entire set of tiles. So I was just pushing them into a corner and then just trying to manage everything else. So I killed like one or two enemies, but I mostly just had like eight things on the screen at once that I was just like trying to manage. And I think I only let like one or two buildings get hit and felt like that was a win by surviving through the turns. But I finished that up yesterday afternoon and then asked Austin, like, so once you finish the second map, you have the option to go to the final island and finish the run, or you can go to the fourth island and try and power up your mechs more, but then you also risk like it ratchets up the difficulty by one notch every island that you continue to go to. So it's a balanced game of like, do you think you have enough to go to the end, or should you like kind of keep progressing through? And I should probably go to the island, and I'm probably going to die there, and it's fine. But like, I'm so stressed because I felt so good about like my arc of this that I just know what's going to happen at that final island, and I just need to do it, but I don't want to do it.
Just play slow. Don't rush into anything. The big one for me now while playing is, am I getting enough out of any given turn? If I'm finishing a turn and all I've done is cleared one thing off the board, that's probably not the optimal play. I can probably clear two and move one or lock one down or something, or put something on top of an emergent spot or some other sort of like positive net thing for me. And so like, there's lots of thinking through a turn. I mean, it's almost an extension of Danielle's triage thing, right? Mm-hmm. So Danielle, your thing is like, how do I protect, or how do I stop these current problems in
stop the bleeding, basically,
in the priority, in the order of their priority. Yeah. How do I make sure that the head wound is taken care of first or whatever?
Usually pretty high up, yeah.
Okay, yeah. It's high up on my body, I must be important.
Yeah.
So that's one, but like the second thing you end up developing is this other sort of medical urge, which is the preventive one, right? Mm-hmm. Like, how do I get in front of whatever the next turn is? And it's not even It's not chess style, I know what the Vec are going to do in three turns, because I don't. I don't have a fucking clue what they're going to do. They move, not randomly, but they move in ways that I can't predict. One time they'll attack this building, the next time they'll literally jump over all of my shit and set up somewhere else. So it's not about what they'll do in terms of what buildings they will attack, but it is what they'll do generally, and what types of things will they do. And so things like blocking emergence points, or if I'm using a something that has fog or fire, setting those in places where it encourages, it shuts down future possibilities for attacks, or makes it harder for them to do. So like the Flame Behemoth set has the kind of prime mech for that just has a flamethrower that doesn't do any damage unless something's already on fire, right? And if it does, if something is on fire, it does 2 damage to it. And so with that mech, whenever I have a chance between, you know, whether I'm attacking something from the left or the right, for instance, I always think, okay, which it can flame out to 2 squares, to be clear. So it can kind of do like a 2-shot line. And so sometimes it's like, okay, well, do I want to shoot this thing from the left side or the right side or the front or the back? Because what extra tile will I set on fire? And so suddenly at this point I'm now thinking about future turns, not necessarily like what to do the next turn, but what to do, what could come up in this ensuing battle, and how to prep so that those things are the most in line for me. The same thing with Patrick, with the Blitz squad. You have the guy who throws the rock, right? Well, like sometimes I'll throw that rock so that it lands in front of a building I'm trying to defend, which will shut down that tile as a place that can, where a bug can go to attack that building. And so it's almost like a shield, because the bug will have to destroy that building or that rock first. And so you end up seeing these things that are like, okay, the same basic strategy is move this thing out of the way from the collision of the rock. The rock's like going to land next to it and push it away. But do I do it from the left side or the right side? And once you start seeing that stuff and start adding onto that sort of the preventative medical stuff, I don't know, like that's when it started to really click into place, and I started being able to consistently get through islands. And then the final battle is still fucking tough as hell. The final battle is still just like, you're going to get pushed to your limits. Go slow. Think about what you're going to do the next turn, and good luck. I believe in you, Patrick. I believe you can get this win under your belt.
Speaking of things clicking into place.
Sure.
I think I'm starting to realize why you slept for 14 hours. Like, this is where my brain is. You're tired.
Yeah, I've been at war, Rob.
It's a long ass week.
It's true. Yeah, that's true. It's only Monday. I've already had a long ass week. No, but last week was long for a lot of reasons. One of them was definitely in my brain. My brain has been pushed further than it has been recently, because Into the Breach is making me use all of my tactical brilliance in a way that even something like XCOM does not. Like, Into the Breach is not an XCOM. You don't get to just, like, fudge it now and then.
I also,
you know,
wouldn't say a lot of tactical brilliance has been on display in XCOM, but
it hasn't pushed me to be there, is what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. Like, if XCOM was as hard as Into the Breach is, I think first of all, those streams would just be us silently looking. We should do an Into the Breach stream at some point, Rob, just so that, like, we can see what the vibe is, because I bet it would be way less jokey and way less, like, me slipping into character voices, and way more just like,
Oh, fuck.
Yeah, just like the Bunk McNulty fuck scene, except just like giant bugs killing us over and over. It's just such a different vibe for me. Like, that's the thing, is that it doesn't scratch the XCOM itch for me at all. It doesn't scratch the Fire Emblem itch for me, even. Or the Advanced Wars one. Like, it is a different thing. It is more chess-like. It is more puzzly. I really, really, really like it a bunch, and I'm hoping that other people find their way to having a positive relationship with this hell game that hates you.
I feel like last thing I'll say on this is that it's probably my favorite game this year so far by, like, a giant stretch. And hey, last year at this time, that was saying a hell of a thing. So we'll see.
That was true. I mean, last year at this time was like such a wild thing in terms of releases, though.
That's true.
Comparatively.
True.
Awesome. Anyone else playing stuff this week other than Into the Breach?
Well, so
I just want to get go ahead.
Well, so like we're talking about.
Let's take a quick break before we continue. I just remembered. Let's actually do that this time. Let's take a break. I'm gonna take one. We're gonna take a break. We'll be right back, and then Rob will talk about something obtuse, probably, but interesting.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
All right, we are back. Rob, hit us.
Okay. So, I like chess-like games as much as the next person, for sure. But I also like really Baroque military combat sims.
Oh, okay.
And that is why lately I have been playing Command Ops 2, which was a game we did for 3 Moves Ahead. We do sort of an annual like wargaming series, but I haven't been able to stop playing it. It is, on the surface, the driest looking, like, this looks
Rob,
like...
I gotta tell you, this looks gray. Like, the map doesn't even have color on it, dog.
It's a bit
what is this game called again?
Command Ops 2.
Also, wait a second. This just says, no hexes, exclamation point. No micromanagement, exclamation point.
Well, okay, that second part is a fucking lie. That is, second part is one of the biggest lies in marketing I've ever heard.
Is this game made in MS Paint?
You know, it looks a lot better once it's moving.
Okay.
But it does look like something that students at like the Army War College might be like required to play at some point.
Totally. So what is this that I'm looking at? It says check your range now. I'm checking it.
Okay, so Command Ops 2 is it is sort of a command simulator for World War II battles. And it sort of positions you at like, you're not quite commanding like the entire army, but you're like sort of mid-tier, right? Like you're just at a high enough level that like the individual placement of like particular weapon systems and squads, like that doesn't matter to you. You're giving your orders to people who worry about that stuff.
Okay.
But it's about bringing all these complicated pieces together and having all these independent like fighting units coordinate their efforts to good effect to achieve the objective. The other thing
can you explain to me what the view, so the map is like very, very basic, lots of grays and browns, lots of just like, oh, here's like an icon, here are like, here's a texture that I guess means some tree cover,
yeah.
Maybe there's some elevation data because like,
oh, there's
this gray
lines.
Is, yeah, this gray is like a little bit darker and then that gray is much darker and I'm guessing that means that it's higher up. But like, what is the how big are these command? How big are these operations in terms of like space? Like, you said you don't really care about particular weapon systems or something. But like, am I looking at miles on this screen right now?
So if you bring up the grid, it's like a single map is going to run several kilometers across and several kilometers, you know, north and south. Like you're talking like several square miles. And some maps like many, many square miles. So like basically if you were like commanding D-Day, for instance, the entire landing zone plus several miles inland would be on your map.
Okay.
Like that's what you're looking at.
Cool.
And in terms of like, what the experience is,
let's use the D-Day example. Actually, that's a really good one. Talk me through what D-Day would look like in terms of what you're doing as a commander, because I think everyone listening has played a game or seen, you know, Saving Private Ryan, something that has had this sort of D-Day style landing.
Yeah. So have you ever seen like a war movie where like there's a certain point and like there's literally I think scenes like this in The Longest Day, where people are gathered around like a command map or like a sand table exercise showing like what the operation is going to look like overall. And here are your assignments. You're the person standing there with like the pointer and handing out the orders to each individual like commander in the room. And so like what you'd be doing in the case of like, say it's right after the D-Day landings, you've established a beachhead. Now you need to push inland. You'd be going around to like different like sub-commanders, you know, colonels, majors, and telling them, like, okay, your battalion is going to push up, you know, Route 3, and you're not going to stop no matter what kind of resistance you hit until you capture, like, Sanlo, for instance. And meanwhile, moving in parallel on the next road over, this armored division, every single unit in it is going to move up that road. But it's going to be a probe. If they run into problems, halt. We'll figure out what to do next. That's kind of what you're doing.
So, and you're not, to be clear, that means that you're not, it's not like an RTS where you're clicking and then clicking on a point and saying, go here. Instead, what you're doing is like, or are you doing that?
This is the genius. You can do that, but okay, should you? Because the thing about this game is that every time you give an order, and as units sort of push out there and start engaging in combat, the situation gets more chaotic. Units now have their own shit they're dealing with. If you are constantly like sending micromanagement orders in there, you're going to snarl the entire process because there's an orders delay that builds, the battle gets more chaotic.
Ooh, that's so interesting.
Yeah, so like you might see something going down, but then you look and no orders of yours are likely to reach that unit for 40 minutes.
Oh, God.
And in 40 minutes, what's that situation going to be? Is your order right, even going to be like appropriate to the situation?
Right. On your order can't be like back up into the forest. Like by then that forest's on fire. Like that unit has been already dispersed and like they're not even going to be near a forest. They're near a river now. Why the fuck would you tell us right, to go into the forest? There's
but
no
it
forest
might be
here, asshole.
You might need to do that though because the right, commander in charge is still probably going to be trying to execute your last order.
Gotcha.
And so that, like, in 40 minutes, if you don't do anything, it's possible that that, like, attempt to execute your order is going to lead to a catastrophic fuck-up. And so what you actually do need to do is race in there as quickly as possible, get somebody over there to say, like, look, this attack needs to stop, pull back to the tree line, everyone go into defensive. And, like, feeling out that moment, like, when you need to do something and when you just need to, like, trust your sub-commanders is really kind of the heart of this game. The other part of it is you've got like you can issue orders directly to like a tank company, for instance, or you can talk to that tank company's like headquarters, which will command every unit in that formation. So instead of one tank company, it's got five under its command.
Right, right.
So you can like do that, but that means that that headquarters unit is going to handle each of those subunits via the AI.
Some way, right. Some way that you might not want.
Right. So, like...
So, it's, like, very useful for moving a bunch of tanks, like, a ton of tanks to a general front, but maybe not as useful for, like, hey, capture this place, because you probably have a specific way you want to capture it, versus just, like, hey, go do this, and then the AI just throws them against the wall.
Right. And the AI is not bad, but, like, exactly. Like, for those, for, like, those key movements, you're probably going to want to issue really precise orders. And so that's the other thing is there's like a tool set. It's a bit like a sports sim in some ways. You basically like outline the game plan for the attack for each unit. You can be like, okay, I want you to conserve ammo for this attack. If you run into resistance, any kind of resistance, just call things to a halt, whatever. Or you can give people the, you know, full green light and be like, if you see something anywhere, just open the fuck up. And
classic
keep going.
Command line.
Yeah.
Just fuck them up.
Pretty much. So, like, what do your orders look like? What orders do you cut? And it's just, it's this really cool experience of, like, basically dealing with the ambiguities of, like, command. It's not like a war game, which tends to be puzzle-like. This is very organic. You're not trying to capture a hill because it's an objective. You need to, you end up getting pulled onto that hill because you keep taking fire from enemy units that are on it. Like, there's no objective there. You just can't leave that hill open. You need to get somebody up there or you're going to get ruined.
Right.
And so it just feels a lot like, feels a lot like the military history you read, right? Like the why decisions are made the way they are, why sometimes there's like inexplicable mistakes. Well, it's because command gets super chaotic.
Right. That's interesting. I think it's so rare that games that, especially games that pass through to a wider audience in the strategy space, even think about the material, like, operation of command. The notion of, like, being able to click a unit and then tell it to go do a thing instantly, and how, like, that isn't a thing you could do ever Like, there's always some delay of command, even now, even with, you know, like, communications technology, but especially in World War II, especially in ancient times, the idea of, like, clicking on a unit and being like, oh yeah, just go here and fuck them up, is just like, no, no, someone had to run over there and tell them that. Or, like, we had to have a radio operator, and what happens if the radio operator gets killed? It's one of the reasons why I really liked a game that is not strictly a strategy game, which was Chrome Hounds, a fantastic mech game from the Xbox 360 made by FromSoft, in which the only way to talk to your other, like, people on your team was to have a specific command mech and to capture a radio outpost. And that was the only way that you could actually speak with the rest of your teammates. And it was so good. Like, yes, interesting. Like, this is a very mechanics first exploration of what, like, warfare actually looks like when it comes to command and operations and logistics and all that. Because otherwise it's just, like, impossible to say, hey, actually let that front go a little bit, come back to base, like, back out, back off of it, let them have that for now, because we want to double down over here on the other side. And games that at least dig into that stuff, or that make it, like, it's one of the reasons, one of my big complaints against, not complaints against, but something like a lot of the Paradox games, in which there's full transparency on whether or not a ploy will work or not, has always bugged me. Not bugged me, but, like, I would love the version of that in the political sphere, things are more unpredictable, or more like have a material less transparent sort of flow to them. Because just like in warfare, we're like, yes, if the command arrives 40 minutes late, everything falls apart. That's also true in politics. And I want that in strategy games in general. Not I don't want it to be the only way to do strategy games, but I'd like to see some more of that stuff in games like Crusader Kings or Stellaris, you know? I just want our space, because the other game we've been playing lately is Stellaris. And, you know, one of the things that we're able to count on in that game is, for people who don't know, we've been streaming that. We have a group of rad space utopian leftists who constantly have their utopia smashed to the ground because of the fact that they have to interact with other people. And also those other people happen to almost always be shitty slaving despots.
Or nice horsies. There's one nice horsey race.
I think
the horses are militarists. Are not great.
The horses are about to enter the atomic age and are a mix of militant, authoritarian, and some other third bad one.
Corporatist, like capital, yeah.
Oh, that's
yes,
right.
Yes, corporatist, capitalist.
Why did I think the horsies were nice?
The llamas are nice. They are
the
pretty.
You're right, I'm sorry. It's the and llamas the horses, who are nice.
The horses live in our territory, so they're nice by, like...
Yeah.
We're trying to take care of them. We want to make sure that they're not... I don't know what we're going to do with the horses. If the horses show up and they're bad, I don't know what we're going to fucking do. Anyway, my point is, we can count on certain things. We can count on when the thing comes up and that says, like, oh yeah, we want to have a research agreement. Yes, we're going to get the research agreement. I understand that to some degree that's about ease of use, because if we had sent off a thing saying, hey, we think you'd like to do a research agreement with us, and if it came back no, that would suck, and it'd be like, ugh, like, I guess we're just going to keep trying this until it works. And I get that, but I would love some degree of ambiguity or, like, lack of confidence in what's going to happen. I guess Stellaris does it through those events, right? Stellaris has, like, science events where you're like, give this a shot, I guess. We'll find out what the fuck happens. Try to open the Infinity Cube or whatever.
Yeah, I think with games like that, I think the real hesitation for embracing a design like that is just the more you start doing that and making it feel like there's, like, a black box inside the game, the more it will just be outrageously frustrating, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, I'm thinking back to, like, some of the earlier Endless games before they really... Well, they never really did get diplomacy very right, but there were certainly earlier iterations of, like, Endless Space 1 and Endless Legend, which made it feel like you were just sort of pushing stuff out there and, like, hoping it would make something happen, like, on a diplomatic front. And it didn't feel like it was under, like, great control. It didn't always feel like it was clear to you what exactly the state of play was. Paradox's solution to that has been, we're going to give you an avalanche of detail, but it's very clear how the math is working, and it's utterly deterministic. Whereas this game, what's interesting is, it's also putting all its cards on the table, but uncertainty is built into those cards, right? Like the fact that like it is a real time game. Once you start letting it run, it's sort of plausible continuous time if we're being persnickety about it. Mm-hmm. But the uncertainty is you just don't know what's going to happen in terms of like what is actually going on with each individual unit. You can always pull up detailed information, but it's just the game is fluid enough that it feels much more uncertain than it actually is.
That's interesting. One day, Rob, you will sit me down in front of a computer and make me play games like
Tuesday afternoon. Command Opt.
Not this Tuesday afternoon, but a Tuesday afternoon.
Soon.
Yes.
You'll love
this,
I promise. And so will the Waypoint audience. Everyone's gonna be like,
I can't wait.
Damn, look at this gorgeous game. This attractive minimalist presentation really speaks to me.
God. All right. I will commit to a Tuesday afternoon again. Probably not this Tuesday afternoon. Things are hectic right now. But soon, for sure, we'll dig in and you can show me Command Ops 2.
It'll be like 3 hours before we can even start the scenario. It'll be great.
Oh my God.
You'll love it.
Great. Yeah.
Good. Ugh. Does anyone else have anything to bring to the table today?
I don't know. I blacked out for like 25 minutes.
Don't worry about it.
Are we still recording the podcast?
This is Waypoint Radio, episode 1.
Thought this was the Austin and Rob podcast.
Episode 1 something. I don't know. I'll find out what it is in 40 minutes when the command's orders get here. I'll know what episode this is.
I want to do a quick shout out to a game called Florence that came out a couple of weeks ago, at least on iOS. I'm not sure if it's on Android or not. One of the co-designers of Monument Valley, I believe, split off to do their own studio. I think that was two people that chiefly put together that game. I don't know that particular, but I believe that might be the case. Anyway, Florence is like a short 30-minute interactive comic book. Is probably like experimental storytelling. I guess presented in sort of a panel-like form with brief bits of interactivity that are not very gamey. They're more just kind of giving you like an example. It would be one of the characters. It's about a relationship and sort of like the arc of a relationship. And like one of the sequences, one of them is a painter. And so like there'll be a painting on the screen and then you will scrub away the painting and it will like reveal something about the relationship. It's a very interesting approach to telling a story. There's no dialogue. It is all conveyed through audio and visual presentation. I think it succeeds in like being a really interesting way to tell a story that itself is not particularly revelatory, but its presentation makes it feel fresh and interesting. And like I said, it's only 30 minutes long. There's not much to it, but it kind of gets in and out in a way that, because it's a very familiar story, it doesn't drag along what it's trying to say. It just says it and then moves on. And I think it's worth checking out for the ways it tries to approach that kind of storytelling.
I'll check it out.
Nice. I like a game that says what it's going to say.
I can find 30 minutes.
Yeah. It's moving.
Uh-huh. That's what you love, Rob.
Like clear, concise orders to an armored battalion.
Perfect. Good. God. All right. If no one else has anything else, which it sounds like we're clear, I'm going to take a dip into the question bucket real quick. If you have questions, you should send them to gaming@vice.com. We will dig into the bucket and pull something out every week. This one comes in from James from Utah, who says, "Hey, gang, as someone who has been a fan of the Battlefield franchise since 1942, the game, not the year, I'm really excited for Battlefield 5 or Battlefield V. We'll have to find out what they're actually going to call that thing, as it has been presented so far. However, my sensibilities about fascism and the common, quote-unquote, German and Japanese soldiers have evolved quite a bit since the last time I played a World War II game. One of my favorite things about Battlefield 1 was its generally humanistic flavor, but I feel quite a bit different about a space that includes the Holocaust and the occupation of China. Do you think there's space for Battlefield 5 to toe a line similar to Battlefield 1 without getting too mushy about the people who made fascism possible? And how does all that play out in a multiplayer mode where one team is going to be donning Axis uniforms? Thanks, James from Utah." I think this is a really interesting question because for people who don't know, Battlefield 1's story mode basically hopped all around that conflict and showed it from every possible side. Not every possible side, but from multiple possible sides. And kind of did the, like, here's how this person's life was impacted by World War One. I'm curious to see if that's how they do World War II, or if it's just that same thing, but only from the Allied side, which is probably my suspicion.
Yeah. Good luck if you're going to try to do both sides-ing that one. That would be The storytelling on display in both Battlefield 1, I admired what they were trying to do. I think it was an interesting approach. It was something I wanted to see them explore more of. But between that and Battlefront, or Star Wars Battlefront 2, yeah. Like, this is not a studio that seems necessarily equipped to, like, try and tell the story of... that just seems really... just don't. Just, I mean, yes. Like, do I want someone to do that? Like, in some... like, on some level, yes. But I just don't know that, like, that's the game, that's the studio, or that they have proven that, like, maybe they could pull that off.
They are on the chops, yeah.
Yeah. And I just don't know if, like, a Battlefront game is necessary. Like, just given, like, what needs to occur mechanically, and I just don't know that that's necessarily the world to explore that. But I am interested to see what they do with their storytelling in this one, because they were on to something, even if it didn't necessarily land in all the ways that they wanted. But they definitely were on to something in terms of the presentation, like the fact that it was just little vignettes as opposed to we're gonna do like a big through line. Like was fine, and in some ways works better for like a familiar conflict in which. Like, what's the new way we're going to gin up you following this set of soldiers around? Like,
right.
Maybe don't. And maybe just, like, pluck a bunch of sort of short stories that you can both, like, sort of convey to players mechanically what they're going to be getting into for the multiplayer, which is also what the single player functions as. So, I'm curious. But, yeah, with the question person proposes strikes me as difficult in the extreme.
I'm curious, too, what they end up doing with multiplayer, as the question asker brought up. Like, it's been a little. What did Call of Duty World War II do with it? Was it just Allied and Axis?
Yeah.
So there's like, let's go for it. I think that's probably what's going to happen, and I suspect most players are going to be fine with it. There's a degree to which I think there's a compartmentalization that happens, especially when playing multiplayer games, because your character is not a member of anything. Your character is a collection of gears and gear, you know, icons and perk upgrades and weapon modifications. That's who your character is. They just don whatever uniforms tossed at them during the spawn screen, you know? And that's kind of, I think you would need a game to really lean into some sort of like narrative side of multiplayer for people to actually become upset by that. More power to people who are like, no, I really can't dig being able to put on, you know, the soldier of a, or the uniform of an Axis soldier, a German soldier, a Nazi soldier. Like, I can see where you're coming from there for sure. I've done it so many times in games, like, especially growing up, especially playing multiplayer shooters. It's just like, yeah, no, one side, I mean, this is just Counter-Strike, right? Like, who are you playing as? Are you playing as the terrorists or the counter-terrorists? Every time, just flip it around. And it's definitely always been a weird thing. Obviously, America's Army, I guess, is the one that stands out as being a game that avoids that issue, quote-unquote.
We're all Americans here.
Yeah, exactly. Are you familiar with... Are y'all familiar with...
Oh, yeah. That bridge level was good.
Wait, which bridge level?
Oh, America's Army? The
I never played America's Army.
It had one legit great map that was sort of a battle for control of a bridge. One side's holding it, and the other side is trying to storm it. It was quality.
Right. Good.
But
great.
It turns out, like, maybe there's a, you know, commentary that, you know, we've met the enemy and he is us.
Right,
that,
of course.
That each side thought that they were America's Army.
That is, for people who don't know, when you played America's Army, which is a game produced by America's Army, you always played as America's Army. You never played as Op4. You never played as the opposition. You were always saw yourself as America's Army, in America's Army.
Yes.
So that was a very specific way for them to build a game to help recruit people into America's Army. I'm going to move on so
AA.
I don't say America's
different
Army
AA,
again.
But you know,
it's a different one. This one comes in from Lillian, who asks a very important question: are cars counted as mecha? What does count as
this.
Mecha? In a discussion earlier with some friends, I came to a requirement that it was articulated functional joints. But are there like good understandable requirements? We know there are non-humanoid mecha, that horse in G Gundam for one, and stationary ones. Are those cranes for shipping containers mecha? So I think this is a good question, and the answer is, yeah, well, because the answer is really broad, but also very specific. In Japan, if you're a mecha fan, it does not only mean giant robots. Like, a mecha fan, a mecha otaku in Japan, mecha is just short for mechanical. So yes, cars are mecha, guns are mecha, computers, especially ones that like click and clink and like move in mechanical ways. You can be a mecha otaku who's into like old retro computing. That said, I think the way that we use them, we tend to want some degree of articulation. We do want there to be limbs, even if they're not humanoid limbs, or a turret that moves or something. But I'm a mecha descriptivist, not a mecha, the other one. I'm so tired. I need to sleep so much more.
So where does Into the Breach fall?
Top Gear was mecha.
Top Gear is definitely mecha cult. Like, I guarantee you, if you go to Japanese mecha forums, you will absolutely see them posting about Top Gear, 100%. Car mecha is, like, a huge thing. Into the Breach, they're all mechs. They're all mechs. That's why, like, even though one of them is just a tank what rams into things, it does just say, like, ram mech or whatever. And, like, yeah, all right, that's a mech now. I'm good with it.
Ramming mech. Yes.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
I'm glad to clear up this question for you, Lillian. I'm going to do a couple more because there's a couple more here that really, really line up with the conversations we've already been having. William Langley asks, did the timelines in Into the Breach always exist, or are they created when you jump back in time? If it's the second, am I a monster for repeatedly abandoning timelines after a bad turn one? Thanks, Will.
Ooh! Yes,
so kind
and
of
no.
An Archangel kind of situation.
Right.
Yes and no.
What's the no? What's the yes? What's the yes? What's the no?
Yes, they've always existed. If you if you hold with multiple universe theory, and no, you're not a monster because you're doing your best, I hope.
But what if you're abandoning your timeline?
You're only doing. This is saying as if you're doing it in good faith, and you're only doing that to give yourself the best chance for at least one timeline existing. Because in this scenario, if this is all real and people are dying, if you give up on the game before you win the game and save humanity, that's the ultimate bad thing that could happen. So even if you're abandoning timelines and people are dying, at least one timeline has a chance.
Okay, but this is the immediately after a bad turn one. Not three islands in and I have to make the decision, do I want to save Ralph Carlson or not. This is bad turn one.
You know,
that's bad.
You're
a bad person.
You're right.
Also, I have bad news. Like, winning Into the Breach doesn't save humans across all timelines.
No, I understand. So many... I'm saying it saves some people at some point.
I see. Yes.
Some good is done, possibly, if you win.
Danielle's over there being like, you know, the Lutesses were really the heroes of Bioshock.
God. Ugh.
Lord.
5 years. Oh, man. All right. It seems. Does anyone else have any feelings about time travel ethics?
I'm just glad they frame it that way because it would have been very, just restart. To try again. Like, it makes it all the weirder. For it to be like, nah, you just that timeline's fucked. Like, see ya.
They do some good humanity. Work. So the game was written partially, at least, by Chris Avalon, and the writing has some really great little nods to the time travel weirdness. There's definitely one where I think it's Bethany, who's one of my favorite pilots, when she finds a pod, is just like, I wonder if I could be in one of these pods.
Yeah.
And then it's just like, yeah, why couldn't she be? Could you meet yourself in a different time pod if you were one of these pilots? That would be fucked up. It's very interesting.
She definitely came in a pod for me. So
totally, but could she
see herself again?
Yes,
she totally could.
Or is there only one across the timelines? Are they all out of the timeline now and different types of beings that exist across the timeline? So there's only one of them, or are there infinite them?
This sounds like
probably infinite. Actually,
is that what I haven't seen the Cloverfield paradox yet?
There's some crossover.
My phone is ringing.
Into the Cloverfield Paradox, the new game
from Waypoint.
Hey, some of the creatures in Into the Breach look a lot like Clovey from Cloverfield, so not that far off.
That's true.
Are they
there's specifically one
tomorrow.
Creature.
Yes. Edge of Tomorrow.
Hell yeah.
That's the
I think they are. I'm pretty sure they are.
Because they have, yeah, they've said they wanted to do a sequel that apparently, like, is a straight up sequel, like, picks up after the last moments of that movie, which, like, is okay. Like,
oh, do you see what the name of it is?
I don't think, have they announced this? They did announce a sequel's title, didn't they?
It's Live, Die, Repeat, and Repeat.
No!
Yeah, bad. Extremely bad. That will not survive. That will not be the title of that movie.
They continue to struggle to figure out a way to, something to call this movie by.
Name their movie? Yeah.
Name their movie.
Just call it the underrated sci-fi movie part two.
That'd
that movie's good.
That movie's great.
I like it a lot.
Yeah, yeah, it's a great,
Emily Blunt is fucking phenomenal in that movie.
Oh my god. Okay, so here's the thing. The other thing, there's a Sicario 2 they're making. What? And yeah, Villeneuve and Blunt are both off the project. It's just bad. Benicio del Toro, like, killing people with, like,
yeah,
impact.
Yeah, dude, it feels like it doesn't understand what that movie is. No. It doesn't understand what that first movie is.
It's like, man, wasn't Benicio del Toro awesome as he murdered all those drug dealers with, like, righteous fury?
And, like, yes, but there's a point to that first movie.
Right.
And it's not that there should be a sequel of more of that.
My understanding is that it's supposed to be part of, like, three movies.
Oh,
so.
My God.
Okay.
Oh, my God.
We live in a world. We do. We really do.
More Emily Blunt action vehicles, please.
Yep.
Agreed.
Yep.
Agreed. What's she working in now? What's she doing? Is she in any video games? How do we bring this back to video games?
It doesn't matter.
When I Google search, I'm going to see what comes up with Emily Blunt video games.
She's doing the voice for a character named Juliet in an animated movie coming out this month called Sherlock Gnomes.
Oh!
I've seen trailers for that. I look through the kids' movies to see what's coming my way.
Okay?
Like, you know, it's my,
because, look, I love me some Mouse Detective.
It doesn't look very.
No, this looks bad.
Looks bad.
Good.
But she is going to be in my anticipated movie of the year, A Quiet Place.
That looks good.
John Krasinski, what's his face?
Jim
from
The Office.
Jim from The Office.
Uh-huh.
His directorial debut.
I didn't know he was directing that. I knew he was in it. I didn't know he was directing
it. Yeah, he directed. It's his first movie, and it premiered at South by Southwest this weekend and was apparently, like extremely good. So, also, apparently, Ready Player One is better than trash, which doesn't necessarily mean it's good. That's the impression, the reviews coming out basically suggest, like,
Emily Blunt was secretly in it.
Okay.
I mean, that would help.
As Rita from Edge of Tomorrow, I just stumbled onto the Internet Movie Firearms Database, and I just have to log off.
Yeah. Oh,
It's just Emily Blunt can be seen using the following weapons in the following films, and then it's a breakdown of what weapons she uses in her various movies.
Okay, let's stop.
I'm going to leave. I'm going to back off. We live in a fucking world,
y'all.
Anyway, I hope Emily Blunt gets to do a video game one day.
That
would be cool. I'm Austin Walker. I think it's going to do it for us this week. On that note, as always, thank you for listening. You can follow us at twitter.com/waypoint, facebook.com/waypointvice, waypoint.vice.com for everything else, pretty much. You can follow me on Twitter, Austin_Walker. Where can people find you, Danielle?
At Danielle RI, or also at Emily Blunt Fan Club. Pushups.com. Yep.
Wait, what was that last? What was the last bit?
Emily Blunt Fan Club.
Do
pushups.
Do pushups.
She does these amazing pushups in Edge of Tomorrow. Live, Die, Repeat. Whatever you want to call it. That's how she begins. They're called God, I forget what they're called, but it's like you go under the fence and you go under the fence again. You go under the fence. You go under the fence again. They're really, really great for your traps. All I'm saying. And your triceps, actually. Yeah.
Good to know.
Yeah.
Those. I remember those. Okay. Yep. Yeah, I've now looked up a video. Rob, where can people find you?
At Rob Zachney on Twitter.
How about you, Patrick?
I don't like the term traps. It's, I don't know.
I meant the muscle.
Don't call my body.
I'm sorry.
I get it. I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying if someone tells me, like, go work on my traps, it's just, I don't know.
I understand. It sounds weird. It sounds weird.
You just got to raise your crafting skill.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. Fine.
That'll get me good at Fortnite.
Finally. I play Fortnite. That's the other thing I played.
Stop it. No, this podcast is an hour and 10 minutes long.
I didn't like it that much. I tried. I just tried. There's a guy jumping at me. He had a shotgun. I had a shotgun. He kept building a wall so I couldn't shoot him. And then I shot him and he died. We jumped a lot. There was a lot of like bunny hopping. And then I killed him. I took his stuff. And then I built a stairway. And then I got killed by another guy.
You sound very excited.
I really want to know. I really want to wrap my head around that game because it's so big, and I want to understand it. And I don't enjoy it at all. I enjoyed it as a co-op, the Save the Night one. I enjoyed. I'm not enjoying the PUBG version, the Battle Royale version at all, and I don't know why. So I might continue to put a couple of hours into that this week. Anyway, thanks to you, Boen, letting us use the check. Miss you at the EP Pale Machine. You can find out more about that waypoint.zone/BOEN. All right, that's going to do it for us. Danielle, take us out.
Be good. Be good at it. And do push-ups like Emily Blunt.
Oh, damn. That was an FN Scar H. Oh, but it was visually modified for Edge of Tomorrow.
Peace. Peace. Peace.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.